This is John Sweeney, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee on the 6th of February, 2011. John Sweeney, part two.
Let's talk about dogs, if we may, John.
Yeah, sure.
How did you meet your first husky?
Well, the dogs were spanned in two teams, or in a big long line, basically, with the teams spread out at the back of the base at Rotherhithe. So I imagine, can't remember exactly, but I imagine that Ben must have taken us there pretty soon after we landed and were, you know, let loose on base.
Ben Hodges.
Ben Hodges, yeah, yeah. Now, the doctor who was leaving the year that I arrived, Jim, Northern Irish guy, Jim, I can't remember what his second name was, he'd actually been running the team that I was to take over. And so I remember, you know, within a day or two, getting on with Jim and getting to know this team that obviously was going to be looking for a driver in the coming winter.
The team was called?
The Admirals, yeah. So there, at that stage, the more established team were the Huns, and that team was being run by the continuing field assistant, Asty Taylor. So he was going to be the doggy man for the coming winter. You've heard the term doggy man, have you? So, okay, so he was basically the field assistant with the main responsibility.
Just give me his name again.
Alistair Taylor.
Alistair Taylor.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. Alistair was running the Huns, which meant that the Admirals were looking for a driver for the coming winter. And although the team wasn't really functioning very well, it consisted of a group of older dogs and a group of very young dogs, which hadn't really melded that well. But I could see that that was where my opportunity lay with this team. So although initially it meant taking over a ragbag collection, it did mean that I wouldn't be stepping on somebody else's toes. And certainly Alistair was looking after the Huns, and they were going to be his team for the coming winter. So, you know, first few experiences running with the dogs were disappointing, I suppose, to say the least. The team didn't work well together, and the chap who was running them certainly didn't have didn't actually have the either the time or the inclination to form this team and to form a dog team, to form an efficient dog team and driver. You have to dominate the team. You're the king. You're the chief. This, you know, it's not a committee. It's not a bus you can just jump on and turn the key and off you go. You're the boss. You're the main man, and everyone respects you and does what you say, and they're. Individual feuds and rivalries are subsumed while you're there, because you know you establish a chain of command, and everybody obeys that and they get on with it. Now they might not be particularly happy with it, but as long as you're there, they know that they work and they don't fight, and everybody's happy.
That's the theory, is it?
It's almost the reality. Yeah. But you see, you can't just walk into a team of dogs and say, I'm the boss, I'm bigger, I'm stronger, I've got a big stick, you know. The dogs learn by experience, and the experience of getting to know the team can be very difficult, can be brutal, and quite shocking at times, you know.
How do you mean?
Well, there's always these dog rivalries between the different dogs in the team. So to establish the pecking order, and particularly in a team where you've got an older bunch of dogs and newer, younger, stronger dogs coming up, basically who's going to be the king, you know, the leader of the pack. And they settle these sort of issues with fights. And there's nothing like seeing 8 or 9 big huskies in one big massive brawl to, you know, to open your eyes to the brutish reality of basically trying to manage these carnivores, you know. I think it's one of the things that did in latter years put a lot of people off the dogs was witnessing these fights and how brutal they can be. But in reality, once you'd establish yourself as the driver and effectively the leader of this pack, they became a thing of the past. They became remarkable when they did happen, as opposed to in the early days when you first took over a team or a team was being formed. It was remarkable if you didn't have a fight. But, you know, I was effectively with my team for nearly 2 years, and in the last, I'm sure in the last year, the fights were you could have probably counted them in one hand.
Did you go in there and break up a fight, or was it better to let it resolve itself?
No, you had to break it up. You had to, for two reasons. One, you had to establish your authority over the dogs, and secondly, you had to stop them ripping each other to bits. And, you know, in the early days, these fights would result in torn ears, punctured skin, damaged paws. And effectively, it could lead to the death of a dog. So, there was never any tolerance for dog fights. It was just how brutally you quelled these fights was possibly the question.
What was your battle tactic?
Well, the older guys like Ben and I imagine Dave and that always recommended and went by the old-fashioned system of carrying a short length of rope. And that was used to hit the dogs over the snout or, you know, back of the legs or wherever to try and dissuade them. And physically, you had to just get in there, grab them by their harnesses and collars and just try and drag them apart. And quite shocking when you're trying to haul these animals that weigh, you know, 50, 60 kilos each and they're just in this massive snarling ball of fur and teeth. I don't think anyone who hasn't seen a team dogfight would realise how intimidating and vicious it could actually be.
Did you always succeed?
Well, you always had to stop a fight. How quickly you did it another matter. It did require brutality. I mean, you know, you've got to. I know it sounds difficult to sort of pet owners and that, but, you know, you've got to appreciate that these animals are there to settle some long, drawn-out feuds. And they're not going to let go until they've got what they want, and that's basically their underling sort of defeated and lying on the ground in a pile of torn fur. So it struck me that the sooner you got in and the more brutal you were, the quicker you stopped the fights and the quicker you established your pecking order and your dominance over the team. And I know it sounds, you know, cruel, but that seems to be the way that, traditionally the management of a team was done.
In your time at Rothera in the early 90s, what were the dogs being used for? Because skidoos were everywhere, weren't they?
Yeah. effectively by the early 80s, the skidoos had replaced the dog teams as the main method of transport for field parties. But they were kept on, I suppose, initially as an insurance against skidoos not working, but then they became a very important part of the recreation on base. And there was a lot of arguments right up until the dogs actually left of the very tangible welfare benefits that the dogs provided on base. Even if they weren't a team, even if it had got to the stage where there was only three or four dogs around, or even one or two dogs on the base, that it's this, that, you know, facility for affection and confidence that anybody who has a pet would recognise. So really, the dogs were there for this recreational travel in the winter and during the summer. And I guess that, you know, they did provide this sort of welfare sort of comfort to people when, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So how did they break the news to you that the dogs were going to be phased out?
I think I'm fairly sure I was aware before we went down that the days of the dogs were numbered. Because at that stage, the Antarctic Treaty, you know, had been signed and was in effect, and that, you know, that recognised that all non-Indigenous species except man would have to be removed. So I don't think it ever came as a shock. I'm fairly sure I was aware of it right from day one that the days were numbered.
Did you sympathise with that strategy? Did you say, well, fair enough? Or were you...
Well, of course, there were some very vocal voices within Bass, and particularly Bonnie Fuchs, who said that this was all a load of nonsense. So it was very hard to, you know, if you were naturally inclined to think the dogs were a good thing, it was very hard to hear somebody like Bonnie Fuchs saying that the justifications for removing them were spurious, and to sympathise with that decision, you know, to remove the dogs. So, whereas I guess, you know, we recognised that it was going to happen because the Australians had got rid of theirs, the Argentinians had got rid of theirs. I think we were aware that they were going, and there was, you know, you can't fight City Hall sort of thing. You know, there were, Bonnie Fuchs wasn't in charge anymore, and...
You know, David Drury was in charge, and he was also reluctant to for the dogs to go. But it was, if you like, a gesture of unity with the other Antarctic Treaty countries that the dogs, the British Antarctic Survey, sacrificed the dogs in order to comply with the world.
Yeah, yeah. So I think you know, in general, whereas people felt the dogs were a good thing and they were, you know, a very positive influence on base, and we had a lot to learn from them, and they were that fantastic link with the past. I think there was a general resignation that the dogs were going, and that was it. That was the price of, you know, sort of the modern world.
You were upset by that, or you just went along with it?
Well, when you're presented with a, you know, a fait accompli, even before you entered into the whole experience, then I don't think you could.
You didn't get too emotional.
You couldn't get too upset about it. I mean, I became a lot more attached to the dogs, and I remember it being a lot more upsetting when they did actually leave. But you know, that was 2 years later, and I was going with them, and it was much more. It was almost as much an experience of the end of this era, and not just from my point of view, the fact that nobody else was going to experience this, that I felt sad for and felt disappointed in. But I don't think at any stage we held David Drury or even the Antarctic Treaty as being, you know, to blame for this situation. I think most people, you know, regarded it as just a reality of modern, you know, politics and international relations.
You did the last Antarctic dog sledging trip. Was that just because you were there, or were you specifically chosen for that? Oh, I got that wrong.
Well, in my first winter, I became probably we had the doggy man on base, but I became his understudy in my first winter, and therefore logically I was to become the doggy man for the last winter, and it would have been quite logical that because I was working that closely with the dogs that I would take the dogs out for the final season. But I do remember discussing it with one of the other wintering GAs who at that stage had taken over the Huns and was running the Huns, and whether he wanted to do that trip. But because I was the doggy man for the last winter, then the sort of, you know, the project really fell into my lap.
Did they have to pull rank, or was it just understood?
No, there wasn't any pulling of rank. It was understood that because I'd immersed myself so much in the dog team and the management of all the dogs through the last winter, and it wasn't all, you know, it wasn't all beer and skittles. There was quite a few unfortunate activities that had to be undertaken, like dogs had to be culled and pups had to be culled, and there was quite a few seals had to be shot and things like that, because I didn't flinch from doing any of those things and did those things. It was, and because I was making such a good hand of running my team, I think it was recognised that, you know, that it was going to be my project. I was quite happy if somebody else wanted to do it to, you know, to discuss that, but I didn't feel that Brian, the other GA, was particularly keen to do that project. And as it turned out, the alternative summer project that was offered to him was quite a, you know, quite a nice project. It was down in the Ellsworth Mountains with a geologist. So I think we both were, you know, were quite happy in what we were doing. So now there was within base for that last trip, there wasn't anybody more qualified, and there wasn't anyone who probably wanted to do it as much as I did.
And was it a realistic scientific trip, or was it just a token expedition, token jolly?
Yes.
Which?
Liz Morris was very keen that the dogs would be deployed in the last season, and she did her best to come up with a project that didn't depend on huge amounts of travel, but was a viable project nonetheless. So it's hard really to say whether the project, well, definitely the project was made up to make use of the dogs, but that's not to say it didn't actually perform any useful function.
Right.
So you've spoken to John Killingbake.
John Killingbake, yeah.
And John was employed to survey, and I did the ice cores and temperature measurements. So I think, you know, yes, it came back with some useful science, but yes, the project was effectively designed for the dogs.
It was quite a media project as well, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, a fair bit of coverage in the press, wasn't it?
I don't know, because I didn't see any. But yes, I mean, in the early stages, Liz Morris. Have you spoken to Liz?
I know who she is. I haven't.
No. Yet. Okay. Well, I think any sort of archive material on the dogs should record Liz's views, because she was probably the most vocal supporter of keeping the dogs and their benefits on base amongst the department heads back in Cambridge. And she was very keen that, you know, something useful was done and something was done to mark their passing. And so she did come up with this project at quite an early stage. And yes, as you suggest, there had always been the intention that this would be recorded using a film crew. But as I just mentioned earlier, there had been problems getting sort of, you know, industry funding for this type of jaunt, because the same summer this American group had planned to travel to the South Pole with dog teams, using the cover of the British still having dogs there as justification to bring in dog teams from America. A private expedition was going to fly them down to what was the name of that place?
Palmer?
In the Ellsworth Mountains, private A&I camp at Patriot Hills, and then travel from Patriot Hills to the South Pole with dogs. But the plane crashed on the way in. It was an old guy called Norman... Oh, gosh, I can't remember what his name was.
Leopard?
No, he was an American.
Oh, right.
And he'd been down with Bird in the 50s.
Okay. And so it never happened?
It never happened.
So you were the last trip?
So we were the last trip, but I think the industry funding had gone to film this trip with this 82-year-old, you know, American who was going to travel from Patriot Hills to the South Pole with dogs, which never happened, but it sort of stole the thunder, really.
What were feelings like at Rotherhithe the day you got back from that last trip, the last turning of a paw in earnest?
It had been a very unusual summer in that traditionally, and since the 1970s, the dogs had always been on camp during the summer months. But of course, for the last summer, the dogs weren't at Rotherhithe. So all those people who would usually be, you know, quite heavily involved in looking after the dogs and walking them, exercising them, running them, had nothing to do with them. And then the dogs reappeared. I remember being asked as soon as I got, you know, the dogs back on the span. They came out of the aircraft, we put them back on the spans, and myself and John went back up into the main base building to, you know, have a cup of tea. And I remember somebody asking me, what sort of time, did you have a great time? And I think at that stage, I was getting... I was quite anxious, I guess, about the next stage, you know, packing the dogs up and taking them out, and that's all I could see, and I couldn't see what had just happened, and I couldn't see the fantastic experience that I just had. I was worried about what was and anxious about what was going to happen next.
Well, who hatched this plan to take a number of dogs, the last remaining dogs, to the Northern Hemisphere? Who where did that idea come from? Because they could have just been put down, couldn't they?
They could have been put down, yeah.
Said he heartlessly.
Sorry?
Said he heartlessly, but they could have done.
Yes, yeah.
Several were.
Yeah. There had been a number of discussions about this, and I don't think there was... Certainly wouldn't have been... much cooperation on base with the idea of the dogs being destroyed. But it was certainly, you know, a potential end to the problem. And it was an end that other bases had used, and it had been used within Bass at other times, you know. So it wouldn't have been completely out of form for Bass to say, right, well, when you bring them back, well, in fact, don't bother bringing them back. When you've done this trip, just shoot them, and that's it. And that had happened before. But I think there was no appetite for that sort of end, either in Bass, on base, or, heaven forbid, if that had got into the press. I mean, the uproar would have been unmanageable. So the field operations manager had, I'm sure he had many a sleepless night figuring out how he was going to end all this and what he was going to do with these dogs. So I guess in the summer preceding the last year, John Hall had to go and try and find some place for these dogs to go to, because I think it was a non-runner that Bass was going to deal with destroying the dogs on base, or, you know, or bringing them back to the Falklands and having somebody else do the job there. There had to be some neater solution, or some, you know, more, a nicer end to the story. So I'm not 100% sure how John Hall struck upon the contacts that he did, except that there was an ex-FID working over in New Hampshire, Maine, and in that area, New England, and he had contacts with these American dog drivers, who in turn had contacts up in northern Quebec. And originally, the Huskies had come from Labrador and Quebec. So there's a whole story about how the Inuit communities in that particular area lost their Huskies. And it's quite a sad story. But it was familiar to us from reading the Polar Record that in the late 60s and 70s that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had actually basically culled all the Huskies in these villages. And so it seemed like a very fitting end that the dogs would eventually go back to these villages and replace some of the stock that had been either stolen or bought or culled.
You've written quite a bit about that trip north, but I'm just wondering, all these years later, we're now looking at 16, 17 years later, just give me one or two ideas of the standout moments from that expedition north, from leaving Rothera to arriving on the Canadian coast.
Bringing the dogs back to Stanley, we flew all the dogs on board the Dash 7 aircraft, so that we had these 22 odd kenneled boxes on the plane, and myself and John Killingbeck.
So this was costing Bass money, wasn't it?
Oh, serious amount of money. Yeah. So we were flown. All of us were flown back to Stanley. We landed at Stanley, and I remember we had a welcoming party there, and we took the dogs down to the Agricultural Research Centre, which is at the back of Stanley, and we spanned the dogs out there. And that was quite interesting, to see the dogs on grass. They'd never had that experience yet. It was, you know, just completely natural. I remember
How do they react? How do they cope?
Fine. Completely. Nothing fazed them. Travelling in planes didn't faze them. Running on roads didn't faze them. So while we were in Stanley to exercise them, I used to run them attached to the front of a quad. And you weren't allowed to take dogs into Stanley. Yeah. That's a long-standing sort of a municipal rule there. But I could run them from the agricultural research station down to the airport. And I used to do that in the early morning, and the dogs were fine. I could steer them left to the left-hand side of the road or to the right-hand side of the road or round the bends. There's no problem at all. They were very disciplined. It was quite a big day then when we flew them from the Falklands back to Bryce Norton. Initially, the RAF had wanted the dogs to be tranquilised. But we didn't, the veterinary opinion was that wasn't really necessary and not really manageable either for that length of time. So the dogs were all packed into their boxes again, and they were all perfectly behaved on the plane. We arrived at Bryce Norton in the early hours of the morning, and we were met by a very efficient group of people from a big pet handling business situated outside Heathrow. And all the dogs were loaded into various... If I remember correctly, the dogs were loaded straight into some sort of truck. And off they went to this place just outside Heathrow. And they were all put in the kennels there, and they were fine.
John Killingbeck says Hello magazine turned up.
Yes, so the following day there was a bit of a press event. And certainly British Airways were quite keen to make a bit of publicity.
Funny that.
And they had a picture of one of their hostesses with Tom, one of my lead pair, Tom up on his hind legs with his paws on this girl's shoulder, looking her in the eye. And in fact, that picture was on the paper the following day when we left Heathrow. So I remember it all being held, being organised very efficiently in the UK. The dogs were kept one night. I think only one night in this place just outside Heathrow, and then the following day we were off again, bound for Boston.
And you were picked to do this simply because you'd taken the last trip.
Well, I volunteered to do it.
Was there competition for that, for the honour?
No, I don't think so, no. I don't think John had been particularly... that bothered about doing it, because of course he had his family to get back to.
So it fell to you naturally, I guess.
Yeah, it just fell to me naturally. I had been the doggy man, I knew the dogs, and there wasn't really anyone else to do it, to be honest.
Whose idea was it then that the dog should actually go, I forget the name of the place they ended up in, somewhere in
Nuktuak.
Yeah. So some of the dogs actually got there under their own steam, didn't they?
That's
You drove them.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So who plotted that scheme? Was that you?
No, that was Kevin and Polly, the American couple, Mahusuk Guide Company. And they'd been running dog sled trips up the side of Hudson's Bay using their own dogs and taking fair-paying passengers, so to speak. They decided that these communities, which had lost their huskies in the 60s and 70s, would be a fitting home for these dogs to go back to. So they organised a trip which combined taking some of their usual fare-paying passengers and also taking the Bass dogs, or, you know, the Admirals, my team of dogs, under their own steam from a place called Le Grand, which is in the bottom of the Hudson Bay sort of network, up to this village of Inuktuak, which is about 200 miles further up the coast.
So you were sledging in company?
Yeah. I mean, effectively, their dogs moved at a lot faster pace, and we lost sight of them most days. But our dogs just plodded on, and you know, were capable of carrying much heavier weights, and weren't taking anything like the maintenance that, that their dogs were taking. So, effectively, we travelled in company.
Mm. And again, were the dogs completely unfazed by being surrounded by trees? And
yeah, I remember on the way up, we stopped at where we were staying in Maine. It was quite open, and we used to run the dogs. I can't remember us being able to run the dogs particularly well there. Maybe there wasn't enough snow. But when we got up into Quebec, there was plenty of snow. And I remember going out one day, taking the dogs for a bit of a trip, because it took us about 2 or 3 days to drive up to our start point. And I remember one morning taking the dogs for a run out and hitching up the lead dog and heading off into the woods. And I was thinking, this is going to be weird for these dogs. They've never seen trees before. I'm going to ask her to go past that tree and turn left and then turn right. And she did, completely unfazed. Nothing fazed these dogs. They just seemed to have confidence in whatever they were doing. Yeah, striking it was.
Did the huskies do what dogs normally do to trees? Or do they have to learn that all over again?
Yeah, I suppose they would have to learn that all over again.
From scratch,
in fact. Yeah, from scratch.
So
yeah.
Did they use the trees?
To pee on?
Yeah.
Well, we didn't stop long enough for it. Yeah.
I suppose what I'm trying to get at is an example of them either adapting or not adapting to their new environment.
I guess they adapted to it, but it just seemed, it didn't seem like anything fazed them or, you know, they took everything in their stride. So I can't, for instance, when we travelled from Maine up to northern Quebec, we had to put these dogs into tiny little boxes on the top of a pickup truck. And these boxes were, I don't know, about 2 foot wide, 3 foot high, and maybe 3 foot six deep. And I thought, the dogs are not going to go into these boxes. They're not going to like it. But they just got in there. They just took to it. And they had to spend all day in these boxes as we travelled. Well, obviously, they could lie down in the boxes, but the boxes had just little square mesh doors on them that they could look out. And that's how dogs are transported over there. But
if it hadn't been you, if it had been a complete stranger who was asking them to go in these boxes, would it have been a different story?
Yeah, possibly, yeah. I'm sure it worked reasonably well for the dogs that there was somebody, some constant thing about their existence at that stage when everything else was changing.
Hmm. When you got to your destination, what sort of reception did you have?
We got a very warm welcome in the village. A big crowd turned out to meet us as we came up this frozen riverbed sort of thing. And I made sure we put a bit of a show on by driving the dogs in a fan trace rather than, you know, traditionally in the Antarctic we'd used a line trace where the dogs are in pairs with a lead dog. But the traditional Inuit way of driving the dogs is what's called a fan trace, where each dog is on its own lead. And the dogs are running side by side. The whole team are running side by side, and I did used to experiment with that in the Antarctic, but it has its drawbacks when travelling on crevassed terrain. That's where the paired harness or paired sort of trace works, potentially works better. But the fan trace is ideal on sea ice. And I remember coming into the village, driving the dogs on the fan trace, and you know, there was a big crowd turned out to greet us. And the following day, I was brought down to, I was asked to go and do an interview on the local radio station, and the you know, through an interpreter, I was asked a number of questions about where the dogs had been and where the, you know, where they'd come from, and then there was a sort of a phone in, and various people in the village phoned in, and
in French.
No, this was in Inuktitut, yeah. And they were all, well, there was various comments, but a lot of comments to say they hadn't seen a team of dogs like that in 40 or 50 years, and their fathers used to have teams of dogs like that, and they felt very proud and to see a team like that, and they'd like to hear the words of commands were still the words of command that we used for the dogs were still the same. They were still the Inuktitut words.
Were you aware that this was a momentous occasion and you were the key figure in this?
I don't think so.
Is that just modesty talking?
No, because I think it was a half-finished, well, I don't like to say a half-baked project, but it was certainly a half-finished project. Getting the dogs there was only half the enterprise.
At that moment, it was a momentous occasion. You weren't to know that things would not work out as you'd hoped.
No, that's right. But also, it was the end of the line for me. And whatever feelings of accomplishment I might have had, it was also going to be, you know, it's going to be the end. So,
We now know that the dogs didn't do terribly well. Gradually, they began to fade away and die.
Mm-hmm.
A couple were, two or three were saved and brought back south again.
Yeah, that's right.
By some American friends of yours.
Yeah.
Looking Canadian. Back now over that, would you? What would you have done differently? It's always easy to say this in hindsight. But I get the impression you may have had a plan B if you'd known what was going to happen.
Well, I remember in the final summer writing to every sort of contact I knew, and I didn't know that many people dog sledging, running dog sledging expeditions or outfits, but there was plenty of them in the northern United States, in Norway, in Alaska, and really our dogs, in retrospect, I think there was two ideal solutions. One is that the dogs should have been retired when they got back to the UK, put into quarantine and offered to ex-fids as pets to see out their days. And I think that would have probably been more or less the most sensible and best for the animals. It would have been a disappointment to see a perfectly viable working team broken up. And effectively, by the time we got back to the UK, there was only one proper team left. But it would have been better for the dogs as individuals. The second best would have been if the team could have gone as a unit to somebody who appreciated modern dog management techniques, and looked after them as they had been looked after in the Antarctic. But in fact, they went back to a community who lost the knowledge in looking after dogs, and in fact had never really had the standard of care available that the dogs had had in the Antarctic. So, you know, with the best intentions of the world, the solution that the, you know, that the solution that that did present itself wasn't a good one at all. The dogs were basically abandoned in a place where they weren't going to be looked after, and not entirely for not entirely, you know, because of the people they didn't want to look after them, but they certainly weren't aware of how we looked after them, how the dogs had been looked after in the past, and what we would have expected for them in the future, sort of thing.
Reading your accounts, one gets the impression that the Inuits treated the dogs as they always had done,
yeah,
which was with less care and attention, particularly in the summer when they couldn't yeah. earn their living.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's you have to be sort of culturally sensitive to the way the Inuit had survived, and also why they were at the state that they were at, you know, at that stage with no viable husky teams of their own. You know, but in reality, our dogs shouldn't have been thrown in there, you know, as a half thought out project. What should have happened is I should have stayed there for another year and tried to teach a group of, you know, younger people how we looked after dogs, or perhaps if a Canadian had volunteered, or an ex-FID who'd been working in Canada or Alaska had volunteered to, you know, to spend a year with a local community and our dogs to integrate how they would look after our dogs and how our dogs would fit into this new environment. So, you know, personally, it was a difficult time for me coming into that village at the end. It was the end of the road as far as myself and the admirals went, and I, you know, I sort of recognised that. I'm not sure then how we felt about. I don't think I had any major misgivings about how the dogs would be looked after at that stage. I felt that the chap we were giving them to would look after them, and certainly he gave us assurances that he would look after them. But, you know, it turned out that those assurances weren't really honoured. And within 6 months, it became clear that things weren't going very well.
Did you go back and rescue the three?
No.
Dogs?
A Canadian couple became involved, and in fact, they were our conscience, really. So Leanne Benoit and Louis Molgat became involved in the project in the early stages. I think they probably had the greatest idea of what conditions were like up there, and probably were. I think probably were aware that the project was half baked. But the Americans involved were very strong characters and had these Canadians on board more or less as a, I don't know, a fig leaf to guarantee their safe passage through Quebec. Mm. But Leanne and Louis served as our conscience really afterwards and followed up on the care of the dogs, and when it became evident that the dogs weren't being looked after, did, you know, arrange to send a vet up to Inuktitut to check on the dogs, to try and advise on how the dogs should be looked after, and eventually organised for the remaining dogs to be brought back down to Quebec, to where they were living just outside Montreal.
There were, Andrew Bellas, who I talked to in the autumn, thinks that there was some sperm that was retained. Is that Biff's?
That's right, yeah.
Sperm. But he doesn't know what happened to it. I wonder whether you know what happened to it.
Well, it was put into storage by Leanne and Louis, and the vet that looked, that actually went and did this research project, or did this, you know, went up to Inukjuk to check on the dogs. I think he stored it free of charge in his freezers, and then he was moving practice, and or sold his practice, and the people who took over wanted to know what to do with this stuff, and they said, and you know, because they didn't know the ins and outs of the story, they were a little bit more hard-headed and said, look, you know, we're going to have to charge you storage fees for this, and what are you going to do, you know, do you want them, do you want us to store it? And at that stage, Leanne and Louis got in touch with us again to see, you know, did we want to do anything with it?
Hmm.
But funnily enough, at that stage, the main emphasis in Bass seemed to be about, or certainly within the Bass Club, seemed to be about getting a bronze memorial of the dogs to be put outside, to be put someplace at the Bass headquarters. And this thing came up at the same time, and it was more or less kicked into the long grass, really.
Would the seamen have been viable at this late stage?
I don't know. But there isn't any shortage of good quality sledging dogs in northern Canada, Greenland. What is lacking is, you know, good quality animal management. And it doesn't need our dog's sperm for that. I mean, our dogs were not a particularly genetically pure or unique strain. There was all, you know, there was regular mixtures of new blood and even blood from the Argentine and New Zealand husky lines in there as well. So, you know, our dogs weren't particularly unique, except in their, you know, in their recent history, which really isn't long enough to make them genetically distinct.
So you're trying to preserve romance rather than biology, really?
I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been much more useful to try and pass on some of our limited dog management skills rather than, you know, the individual beasts.
Mm.
But even, you know, even within that there's a story, because the techniques that we were using in the 1990s to look after the dogs hadn't moved on very much from the 1940s. And yet at the same time, you know, in Alaska and the Yukon, you know, dog management had really come into the 21st century with, you know, dog nutrition becoming, you know, an absolute science. So, for instance, in you know, northern Canada and Alaska, these long-distance races like the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest were pushing, you know, the management and welfare of dogs to, you know, new limits. Yet, you know, none of these techniques and methods or science was coming back to us in the Antarctic, which was very sad because, you know, a number of field assistants who had, you know, cut their teeth, so to speak, with the huskies in the Antarctic went on to do some very interesting journeys in the Yukon and in Alaska, and yet none of that information and skills and or techniques were passed back to where they'd originally learnt their skills, you know.
Was that your last job for Bass, to take the dogs north?
No, I went back for two more seasons.
As a GA?
As a GA.
And what in the end prompted you to step away from Bass?
Well, it was a number of sort of personal reasons, really. Settling down with Sharon. my family asked me to come and help in a business because the business hadn't been doing very well. So they were the main reasons, really.
How do you feel about your... Is it 5 or 6 years that you were with Bass? I normally ask this of old men. You're still quite a young man.
I'm still...
In your middle 40s, so you haven't got the same perspective, but...
Well,
do you feel the Antarctic will be a something, an abiding key memory in your memory in your life?
I think what links most people that will gather at the Bass Club reunions is that we all probably feel the same about the Antarctic, and that is that the Antarctic was probably the best experience of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, I've had lots of ups and downs, and I often think that no matter how bad things got afterwards, and you know, over the last few years, we've had, you know, financial troubles with our running a small business. That having had the years working in the Antarctic with Bass, I'm not owed anything. I've had my fun. I've had the most fantastic experiences. I've met people that I'll never forget, and I think your whole life can't be like that. there's got to be a peak someplace, and I think for most of us, the Antarctic represents that peak.
Do you find yourself utilising that Antarctic experience in your working, your everyday life these days? Do you every so often think, oh, yeah, I got that from the Antarctic?
Yeah, I do. I mean, because I work outdoors and because I work in, do quite a lot of manual work, a lot of time involving ropes, involving small machinery. There probably isn't a day that I somehow don't think of the Antarctic. I certainly, a week wouldn't go by when some time or other something wouldn't remind me about, you know, working in the Antarctic. So, I'll have to say that, you know, I came away from Bass on a real high, really. I had a fantastic... Last season, my last two seasons were fantastically enjoyable, and I actually probably found them, although quite different from the final dog journey, very much in the spirit of real GAing, you know, real travel with skidoos and. Interesting terrain and, you know, generally very enjoyable and challenging. And it's certainly something that, you know, I made my decision not to stop working for Bass for various reasons, but not because I didn't enjoy working for Bass. And I think, like many of us, if somebody... phone tomorrow and said, "We need somebody. Would you be available?" I'd have to do some discussions with Sharon, but then I'd be.
I told you.
Yeah. Then I'd be packing my bags.
Have you ever considered going back as a tourist? I mean, every year now there seem to be reunion trips.
I'm sure the time will come when I would go back, but I don't. I don't have the money, and I don't feel that I'm old enough to be a tourist. I mean, you know, I was working in my first season with Bass. I was working with Ben Hodges, who was working his last couple of seasons. And basically he worked until he was 60. So I don't see why anybody shouldn't work in the Antarctic until they're 60. So as I'm still a few years from 60, I would say there's no reason why I shouldn't go back down and work there again. You know, except for various family and technical reasons. But I don't think age is necessarily a barrier to working in the Antarctic. And certainly the more memorable relationships I've sort of taken away from the Antarctic are with those older people who've continued working in the Antarctic, you know, till Bass said, "That's it, there's your bus pass, off you go."
It's been a real pleasure, John. Thank you very much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Thank you.